Stay tuned for another in the series of programs presented by the St. Petersburg Museum of History, Happy Hour with a Historian. Last week, the speaker was Rick Vaughn, former Tampa Bay Rays executive and author of a relatively new book, 100 Years of Baseball, on St. Petersburg's waterfront, how the game helped shape a city. Rick Vaughn was the speaker. Roy Farias is the executive director of the St. Petersburg Museum of History.
So tonight, our speaker is a veteran in the sports communication field, having served more than 30 years with the Baltimore Orioles, the Washington Redskins, and our Tampa Bay Rays. He served as the lead public relations executive and oversaw the closing of Baltimore's beloved Memorial Stadium and the opening of Oriole Park at Camden Yards. He helped launch the expansion of Tampa Bay Devil Rays and its rebranding to the Rays in 2008. He also managed communications for the Rays' historic visit to Cuba in 2016. Along with being a pretty amazing author, and by the way, we have sold out of his books, but he has plenty here for you to buy afterwards, right? Rick is presently the executive director of former Rays manager Joe Madden's Respect 90 Foundation, which provides children and families opportunities to develop championship attitudes through sports, academics, and community involvement. Even if you're not a baseball fan, if you're just a history geek like most of us here, you're going to love this tonight, and I implore you to purchase this book and read this book, because it is a true story of St. Pete's downtown waterfront history. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Rick Vaughn.
Okay, can you hear me?
You're good to go.
Thank you all very much. What a great turnout. Nevin and Rui, thank you guys for inviting me to allow me to do something that I love to do, talk about baseball. My wife is here. Give her a little love. She's in the back. If you're a baseball wife, you're a special person because you do a lot of stuff by yourself. She did. She'll attest that I think during all the years I was in baseball, that spring training was always my favorite part of it. And so this project that I started to work on was really a labor of love for me, writing about Waterfront Park and Al Lang Field and Al Lang Stadium. I did not intend to write a book. I was trying really to get the city to maybe do a better job of memorializing the baseball history over at Al Lang. I'm a big Rowdies fan, love soccer, glad they're here. But I think there's some space over there that we could devote to memorializing the great players that played there. And I just love discovering that baseball started there in Major League Baseball started there in 1922 when the Boston Braves came. 193 Hall of Famers either played or managed on the field over there, on one of those three fields, which were basically overlapping footprints. Ruth, Gehrig, Musial, Mantle, Aaron, Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, Cal Ripken, Barry Bonds, Bob Gibson, Seaver, they all played there. Ty Cobb also played one game here. Interesting story. It was near the end of his career. It was 1927. He was playing with the Philadelphia A's at the time. And they were playing the Cardinals down here. I'm sorry, they were playing the Yankees down here. And he got thrown out of the game. Got a couple hits, but was ejected for arguing balls and strikes and put up such a fight that the umpires walked off and the game had to be forfeited. So that's Ty Cobb's legacy to our waterfront. I learned that there were 23 World Series champions trained here, 37 league champions trained here. It was the only place that the two baseball's Ironmen called home. Lou Gehrig played home games here, so did Cal Ripken with the Orioles in the mid-90s. Murderers Row trained here. Ruth and Gehrig and the 27 Yankees, the Gas House Gang, which was the famous Cardinal teams of the 30s, and the Miracle Mets of 1969, and our own American League champion, Tampa Bay Rays of 2008, which was the last year the Rays trained down on the waterfront. One of my favorite people that was there, he wore actually six different uniforms at Al Lang Field and Al Lang Stadium, was Don Zimmer. And Zim was a 50-year resident of St. Petersburg, and we lost him in 2014. Great friend. Zim was 1964 playing with the Senators, and his manager, Gil Hodges, who was just recently elected to the Hall of Fame, said, you know, Zim, you might be more valuable if you learn to catch. So in the fall of 1964, 33-year-old Don Zimmer came and participated in the Instructional League here at Al Ann. Now, the Instructional League started in right here, first Instructional League game ever played. It was developed in the mid-50s, so it was for young prospects. And it was really just a way back then to try to get these young prospects to the big leagues faster. So they started the Instructional League, and it still exists today in a different form, but it's still around. So here's Don Zimmer learning how to catch at 33 years old, surrounded by a bunch of 18-year-olds. It really told me what kind of a man Zim was, and the times that I got to spend with him, there was no doubt. I have to tell one quick Zim story, and I know it's not related to the book, but I can't talk about Zim without mentioning this story. Zim was managing the Cubs. It was late in the season, and they were in Cincinnati, and they were winning in this particular game 5-2 through eight innings, and Rick Sutcliffe had been pitching for the Cubs, and so he went out to pitch the bottom of the ninth inning, and as he did, Zim called down to the bullpen and said, hey, let's get a couple pitchers up just in case, and Sutcliffe was walking out, but he heard Zim, and he turned around, and he came back to Zim, and he goes, no, Zim, this is my game. Tell him to sit down. I'm going to finish this game. So Rick goes out to the mound, and he gets the first two hitters out. The next guy hits a home run. Well, they're playing in Cincinnati, and they had the exploding scoreboard there with the fireworks. So the guy hits a home run, and the fireworks are going off, and Rick's not real happy with himself, but he faces the next hitter, and he hits a home run. So now it's 5-4, and here go the fireworks again, and they're going off, and Rick's not happy with himself, and here comes Zim out of the dugout to the mound to take Rick out, or so he thought. And Zim says, relax, Rick. I'm not going to take you out. And he goes, you're not? He goes, no. I'm just giving the fireworks guy time to reload. That's a true story. That really happened. In many ways, this book is really about Al Lang. And we all kind of know Al Lang's name. We've seen him on some of the street signs here. We know his name is somewhere on that ballpark, although I haven't been able to find it lately. But the book really, I think, is a timeline of Al's life. And I'm not trying to overstate baseball's importance to the growth of this city, but a lot of what I've written here is really how baseball did influence the city in different stages of its growth. And I can't imagine the city doing what it did without Al Lang being here. He was a two-time mayor. He had two loves in his life, let's say three. Marie, his wife, let's not forget the wives. But he was in love with baseball as a young boy growing up in Pittsburgh, and he fell in love with this city. He recognized probably more than anyone how important baseball was to spreading the word up north about the virtues of this city to tourists. And baseball indeed carried that water up north and really led to the development of the tourism of this city. And Al was the one that really activated all of that. He was such an impassioned leader, such an advocate for the city, spent his time basically when he wasn't near the ballpark out there promoting the city of St. Petersburg. He had much to do with this city going from a small fishing village to really a major media center in the first quarter of every year when spring training came here, every year for five decades. And he was also very smart. He not just brought baseball here, brought some pretty big media markets here. The Braves were the first team, the major league team to play on the waterfront in 1922. They were like the third biggest media market in the country. This whole time, Al had on his mind was the New York Yankees. And it took him a few years. The Yankees were training in New Orleans, and they weren't really happy with the nightlife there, and Babe Ruth didn't really seem to get along too well. So they were looking for another place to play, and Al was able to get them to come to St. Petersburg. One of the things that I really loved reading about and researching, and the research was so much fun, but one of the things that I really enjoyed was when the Yankees came here, as I said, they were coming from New Orleans. They weren't real happy about that, coming from New Orleans to this little town that nobody had ever heard of. Babe Ruth trained with the Red Sox in Tampa in 1919, but there was really no, I couldn't find any record that he'd actually come over to St. Petersburg. So it was all new to them, and they didn't like it. And their first year of training here, which was really the worst year they had in the next 40 years. So their first year at St. Pete didn't go as particularly as planned. But over the course of the next couple years, they fell in love with the city. And the Yankees writers, the New York writers, used to always say that St. Petersburg was really discovered in 1925, which was the Yankees' first year of training here. And they got a big kick out of that. But the deal was contingent on the fact that they would share the facility at on the waterfront here, Waterfront Park. They would share it with the Braves, but they needed somewhere to train. So the deal was contingent upon building Crescent Lake Park, which is still there today. It's called Huggins Stengel. You all know where it is off of 4th. So that was where the commitment had to come from St. Pete, was to build that. And the city council voted to do it, and the Yankees came. Babe Ruth, as I said, was really very skeptical about coming here. He fell in love with the place, and I was able to research his last 6 years with the Yankees. Five times on his birthday, which was early February, before he had to come to spring training, he would come down here to celebrate his birthday. So he really came to love it, and his impact in this city was like you might think it would be. You know, it was a larger-than-life person that was here from 1925 until 1934, and playing with the Yankees, and he was here in 35, his last year. He actually was signed with the Braves, so he was back down here as a member of the Boston Braves. But his impact on the city here was amazing. He was one of the very first people to get involved with fundraising for what's now All Children's Hospital. I think it was the Crippled Children's Hospital back then. But he was the first one to get involved, and people just kind of fell in love with him. When his last year down here was 1935, I said the Yankees, and he had come to an end of the road, but he signed with the Braves. And when he came down here for spring training, I read a lot about the crowds in Florida at each stop on the train were unbelievable, how many people came out to see him. And then when he finally got right downtown here where the train ended, the crowd was amazing. And the impact that he had on the city was crazy. You know, he wasn't a big spring training hitter. He only hit 13 home runs out here on the waterfront in his seasons with the Yankees. But his last home run was, he hit in 1934. The time the waterfront ballpark, the home plate was in the parking lot of what is Al Lang now. So you could see it was further back. And he hit a ball from that home plate against the Braves. And it hit, at the time, the hotel that was there, it was, it's now the same, pretty much the same area is as the Hilton is, but he hit the West Coast Inn, and he hit the second level of the hotel there on the balcony, over 600 feet. And that's that happened a few years ago, so trying to get all of that detail is a little bit difficult. Back up for 1 second on Al Lang. Al Lang grew up in Pittsburgh. Lived near the hotel where the visiting team stayed, the American Association Pittsburgh Alleghenies. There was a team there, and when the visiting team stayed, was near his house, and he spent an awful lot of time at the hotel. Loved baseball, loved hanging out with these players as a kid, so much so that his family had him basically quit school and enter the family laundry business at an early age. Well, Al was very dedicated, and by the time he was in his mid-30s, he had a very successful laundry business. The problem was his health was bad. And so the doctor said, you can't live up in this cold weather anymore. You're gonna have to find somewhere to live. He was at that point independently wealthy in his mid-30s. And there was a bunch of different stories that talk about how Al Lang got here. There's a lot of myths going on there. But the one that I liked the most was he basically went to the train station and said, I wanna go on this train. Marie and I wanna go on the train as far south as it'll take us. And as it turned out, it was right here. And so he got off the train. He had never heard of St. Petersburg. But as I mentioned before, he fell in love with the city and recognized how there was something that he could do to make this city a better place. And Not only did he recognize the baseball tourism connection, but he also cleaned up the city quite a bit and made it very enviable, very presentable for people from the north to come down. One of the things that really I loved reading about was that while he was mayor, he was mayor from 1916 to 1919. While he was mayor, the city hired what was probably, they became the first city ever to hire a PR director just for the city. And all he did was churn out these photos of the guys playing baseball with the water and the sun and maybe a few bathing suited young lassies there. But they really promoted, it got to the point where in the mid-20s, the newspapers up north in New York and Boston where the teams here were training, they didn't even bother putting Florida on their daylines. It was just St. Petersburg, because everybody knew where St. Petersburg was. So it was, you know, again, I don't want to overstate it. It wasn't the only thing that made St. Pete what it is, but it clearly had an awful lot to do with what went on here. And Al was at the center of all of that. The things that I've read that people wrote about him are just incredibly positive. And St. Pete became a very important market for baseball. You know, Al also became an ambassador for Florida. Teams wanted to move there. Back then, teams were training all over the Southeast. It was in Texas or Mississippi or anywhere in between. And Al became this great ambassador for the state of Florida. So it got to the point where if teams were thinking about moving to Florida, it was like, well, you need to talk to Al first. So that's the role that he had and how important this market was. Back in the day, this was actually in 1929, the baseball would allow whoever the league presidents were, they would allow them to pick where their off-season office would be, their winter headquarters would be. And in 1929, the league president was a guy named Ernest Barnhart. He picked St. Petersburg. So in 1929, the offices, the headquarters from November until the end of March, if you wanted to do business with the American League, had to do it right here in St. Pete. That's how important it was. I talked a little bit about another era that I wrote about a bit was the Great Depression. And I talked to a couple of historians, one in particular who told me that he thought that having the New York and Boston markets here during the Great Depression helped us get out of it a little quicker. People with money were here. You went down the street, you saw a lot of New York license plates and a lot of Massachusetts license plates. And that money that came in probably helped us get out of the Depression a little quicker than some other Florida cities. Al Lang, again, to the rescue. They lowered the prices of the tickets here because people had a hard time being able to go to a game back then. And if you know anything about baseball, baseball players don't get paid during spring training. They don't get paid till the season starts. So they're down here and the Depression's going on and all of a sudden they're having a hard time making ends meet. The writers were having a hard time making ends meet. But Al Lang's influence in this city helped those guys get through. He helped them get through. They made sure they got their groceries and they got their rent for their spring training places. And it's pretty amazing. So we get through the Depression. As I mentioned, Babe Ruth's last season was 1935 with the Braves. And the Braves stayed. You know, here we had the Yankees and the Braves. They've been sharing this facility since 1925. Well, now 1937 rolls around, and I think the Braves finally got a little tired of sharing the spotlight with these great Yankee teams, and they left. They left in the summer of 1937, and Al Lang was not pleased. He wanted them to stay because, again, it was a big media market. He didn't want to lose that. But they left. They left on a Tuesday. They announced it actually through the newspaper that they were leaving, and that was on a Tuesday. And by Saturday, Al Lang already had a team to come in. And it wasn't just any team. It was the St. Louis Cardinals. So the two most successful teams, even to this day, the teams that have won the most World Series are the Yankees and the Cardinals. What was still true at that time, too. So here you had the two most successful teams training in St. Pete. So maybe you weren't getting quite the media market St. Louis was, not quite maybe what Boston was. But it was also like the westernmost team at that time. So you had a lot of the western media that were coming in to cover the Cardinals. And because they were such a great team, they demanded some attention. So you had the two of them there. World War II came along. 1943, 44, and 45, baseball did not allow the teams to go south for spring training. They had to stay close to home, and most of them trained either really close to home or within maybe 100 miles of where they were from. So baseball, we were without spring training baseball for those 3 years. And from what I read, Al Lang was the most miserable 3 years of Al Lang's life. He spent most of that time trying to convince the government and Major League Baseball that rather than not have baseball here, there were, I think the estimates were that there were about 120,000 servicemen came through St. Pete during World War II. It was a training center here. And so his reasoning was, shouldn't we have spring training baseball here to give those guys something to do on their off hours? And he pleaded with baseball, and it wasn't until 1946 that they relaxed the rule, and we went back to having the Cardinals and the Yankees here. And then in 1947, they decided to build a new ballpark here. The Waterfront Park, one of those old wooden ballparks, one of the problems that they would have. You don't think about it today, of course, but one of the problems was people smoking in these wooden ballparks. And then the last year, I think they had something like 11 fires at the ballpark. So, you're talking about Waterfront Park was built in 1921, and we were getting a Florida State League team. And so they kind of, it's amazing to think about this. I mean, we're not talking about stadiums that are today. There was a grandstand and maybe some seats along the side, and the rest of it was building the field. But in 1921, they built Waterfront Park in like 6 weeks. And they got the word they were going to have a team, and we had to find it. And they built this ballpark in the grandstand in 6 weeks. This was in 1921. And then we got the Braves to come in here in 1922, and they had to do some upgrades because now it wasn't a minor league team anymore. It was a major league team. So they had that was another thing that Al had a lot of work to do to get that ballpark ready to play, get that very first season going. But anyway, so now Waterfront Park is no more, and they build a new ballpark, and they call it Al Lang Field. And it was on Al Lang's 75th birthday when they told him what they were doing. And in the growing, I won't get into it now, you have to read the book. But there was a lot of angst and a lot of problems to try to get this ballpark built. There was a number of people, and I really enjoyed reading about this, that were so protective of the waterfront. The Times had an editorial that called it everybody's front yard. Why do we need a ballpark on? That's not where we should have a ballpark. So there was this great movement about moving it off the waterfront. And then the Cardinals and the Yankees, both of their owners, came out and said, "Well, we're not interested in training here if it's not on the waterfront." And at the end of the day, I think they realized that for the tourist trade, it was better for it to be where it was. So they built Al Lang Field in 1947. The other great thing that came along with that is we've been without minor league baseball since 1928 for various reasons. But in 1947, when they built the ballpark, the Florida State League came back, and we had a Florida State League team, which we would have a minor league team until the late 1990s. The other thing that I really enjoyed writing about was the color barrier being broken here. Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947 with the Brooklyn Dodgers for Major League Baseball. The first African-American major leaguer to play here was not Jackie. It was an outfielder named Sam Jethro. And Sam was a guy that had played in various leagues, including the Negro League, was signed with the Braves, and was a really good player. And in 1950 was his first year with the Braves, played here, and when they came, but they were no longer playing their games here, they were at another place, so he came in as a visiting player, and went on and won the Rookie of the Year that year. He was in his 30s, but he had never had a chance to play in the big leagues, but he was the first African-American to play right here in St. Petersburg, major league player to play in St. Petersburg. And funny thing about it was that it got very little attention. I couldn't find much at all in my research that he was playing here. It was not much in either one of the Independent or the Times. There was a note in one of the papers that said, "Well, now that the color barrier has been broken here, maybe we can get Jackie to come here." And he did 2 years later. The Dodgers came over in 1952, and Jackie played his first game here. And one of the things I really enjoyed reading about was the impact that he had here. There's only two times on the waterfront where there are crowds of more than 8,000 people in any of those three ballparks, and both of them are games that he played in. The top 11 crowds ever to see baseball over there, five of them were his games. He only played seven games here. So you can see how impactful when he came here, what it meant to everybody. And apparently, from what I could tell, I mean, the crowds were very respectful. And it was not like that all over the South, but here it was. It seemed like it must have been a fairly, given the day, welcoming place. The other thing, the year before, between Sam Jethro in 1950 and Jackie in 1952, there was a really strange kind of thing happened. The Yankees and the Giants, New York Yankees, New York Giants, switched spring training homes. And the Giants had been in Arizona, the Yankees were here where they flip-flopped. And the Giants came here, and the Yankees went out there just for 1 year. But the Giants had three African-American players, and one of them was Monty Irvin. And Monty Irvin, Hall of Famer, and a guy I got to know and love, tremendous guy. So they were the first players to play here of color that trained here, that lived here and played here. And they went through, it was not an easy situation for them. I talked to Don Zimmer's wife, Soot Zimmer, who's a dear friend, still living. And she was at one of the Jackie Robinson games, and she sat with her father. Zim was playing shortstop for the Dodgers, and Jackie was playing second. And they sat, they had temporary seats. There were so many tickets in demand that they sat in the outfield in these temporary seats. And her memory of that day was just everywhere you looked, there were people. It was just this amazing event for downtown St. Petersburg. And by all accounts, it seemed to be a really positive thing. I talked to Steve Garvey. Steve Garvey's from here, a 10-time All-Star, 1974 MVP, I think, for the Dodgers. He grew up here. And I talked to him, and he had a great story. His dad was a bus driver in Tampa. And he was getting ready to go to school one day, and his dad said, I think maybe you better skip school tomorrow. And he was like, what's going on? You want me to skip school? And he got the job to pick up the Dodgers, who were flying in to play the game here. And so he was a bus driver, so he hopped on the bus with his dad and spent the day, you know, driving over to the airport, picking up the Dodgers, including Jackie, and bringing them over here. And when he got off the bus, he ended up, the guy that runs the clubhouse, ran the clubhouse, he said, hey, we need a bat boy for the Dodgers. You want to be the bat boy? So he was a bat boy for Jackie's last game here, and it was really cool to talk to him, and I talked about that in the book. He gave me some really good anecdotes of things that happened, so it's really cool. I wrote a little bit about the 60s. The 60s obviously were a tumultuous time for our country, for baseball, for everybody, and it did not, it was not immune to hear. St. Pete was in the middle of a lot of things. I got to talk to Bill White. Now, Bill White played with the Cardinals, really good player. What became the first black Major League Baseball play-by-play guy on the radio for the Yankees. And then he became the National League president. Really bright guy, and I was fortunate enough to get him on the phone, and he's scuffling a little bit. You know, he told me, he goes, I'm not as sharp as I used to be, but he told me, when Jackie broke the color barrier in 1947, a lot of people probably had the impression that things had gotten better for people, for players of color, but it really didn't, and it especially didn't happen in the South during spring training. There were laws, the Jim Crow laws here were still very much enforced, that the laws that were, again, the laws that were enforced were obeyed by the hotels here. Black players could not stay in the hotels with their teammates. And there were a bunch of, obviously, injustices that happened here. And then when the 60s came, it was a tumultuous time. Al Lang died. Now, here's Al Lang, even at the age of 90, keeping all of this together. Keep in mind that all the time these teams were here, whenever they had an issue, they went to Al Lang. We need this, we need that, and he did whatever he could to keep these teams happy, so they stayed here and brought recognition and wealth to St. Petersburg. Well, he was gone, and so things started to really come to a head. There was a fellow that maybe some of you have heard, Dr. Ralph Wimbish, and he lived in South St. Pete, and he took a role of having these black players either stay at his house or he would find places for them to stay in South St. Pete. And he did this for a number of years. Well, 1960 rolled around, he sort of had an epiphany and said, you know what? Really not helping the situation by doing this. We need to bring this to a head. So in February of 1960, he basically said, I'm not going to do it anymore. So that was the first little bit of pressure that came about. There was a Chamber of Commerce breakfast that same, a month later, at the Yacht Club. And somehow, everybody kind of points the fingers when I did all the research that I did, somehow the black players were excluded from that breakfast. And Bill White, outspoken, did not miss that for a beat. And so that picked up a little bit of speed. Why weren't the black players involved? And at the same time, almost as a footnote really, I didn't even know about this until I just happened on it, Al Lang Field hosted college football games for a couple of years. It was called the Holiday Bowl, and they hosted it in 1958, 1959, and they lost it because there were two things that they really were supposed to do that they didn't do. One of them was to try to build a ballpark for the football. Didn't happen. And that was another thing that Al Lang was trying like heck to lead that charge and was pointing down to the Orange Bowl in Miami saying, they've got it right. We need to do this. It didn't get done. So they didn't have a ballpark, that they, a football stadium, I should say. And the other thing was the housing situation, the segregated housing. And so the actually it was an NAIA bowl, they took the game away. So you had these three things all happen really in the first quarter of 1960, and things started to change. You had Bill Veeck, who owned the White Sox training in Sarasota and was very outspoken for civil rights. Things started to change. They got hotels in Sarasota to have all their players together. And I don't know, it was probably some pressure, afraid that maybe the Cardinals were afraid maybe that they would lose some sponsors or lose some customers for their beer. They started to realize this was not the way that this was gonna happen, that they needed a change. And 1961, the Cardinals bought a hotel down by the Skyway Bridge, and all their players stayed there. And the really cool thing about that was is that a lot of the white players, like Stan Musial, they were staying on their own, and they either rented a house or they were on their own. And when they knew what was going on, they all came back to the hotel. They all stayed in the same hotel. So the players were like, we get it. You know, and I talked to Bill White about that, and he said, we just wanted to win. We just wanted to be together. We didn't care. And he told me that like they would have tourists come by while they were all in the pool together. They were watching blacks and whites in a pool, was something that they had never seen before. And so it was really, I think, was it the end-all be-all for the end of civil rights discrepancies here and deficiencies? No. But it was 4 years before the Civil Rights Act came along, and it definitely started a little bit of momentum. It was a while before any really serious overall for the whole city. But I think this got people to thinking. It certainly got some of the hotels down here to thinking. And then the Yankees left. The Yankees had been here since 1925, and they had a number of reasons why they wanted to leave. And some of it had to do with the facility. They wanted their own facility. They wanted a larger stadium. But one of the things that Dan Topping, the owner of the Yankees, said was, we want our players under one roof. Can't get it done here. So they went to Fort Lauderdale, and they got it done down there. And so all of these things, I think, really had a pretty cool, it had an impression. It left an impression. It took a while for things to get really right, but anyway. So the Yankees leave in 61, and they could leave only if they could find somebody to take their place. And what happened in 1962? Baseball expanded. So here came the New York Mets and Casey Stengel. And a lot of the Stengelisms that you hear these days were uttered first right over here. They actually played fairly well down here that very first year. Now, they went on and lost, as you know, 120 games that year, which is still a major league record. They were 12 and 15 in spring training, so they kind of held their own, sort of anyway. But I wanted to read one thing that I actually loved. It was the lead in the New York Times for the first game that they played here. It was their first game as the Mets. Zim was a member of that team. And Robert Lipsight of the New York Times began his game story this way. Seven white yawls rocked idly and ineffectually at anchor in Tampa Bay today, in perfect harmony with the New York Mets at bat, in the field and on the mound. The boats moored behind the left field fence of Al Lang here at least went nowhere with grace. The Mets, playing their first major league game, lost to the Cardinals without a trace of elan. I love that lead, one of my favorite leads. But they were a beloved team here, and Casey had a lot to do with that. Zim told me a few stories about playing with Casey, and you know, he had managed the Yankees, and you know, he had all these great players, and now he's managing the New York Mets, and he told me that Casey didn't even know half their names. It was a little different thing, you know. He wasn't quite attuned to what was going on there. The Mets had Willie Mays in 1973, and he trained right here at Al Lang. He had a bad left knee, and he only played in five games here, but he hit three home runs here in only five games, which I thought was really cool. Anyway, the 69 Mets, maybe the most famous team in our lifetime, trained here, obviously, and I got a big kick out of the fact their first game, you know, the first game of the year was, of course, here in spring training. And it was a really bad day. And they played their first game. This is going to be the future World Series champion New York Mets. And their first game they played in front of 458 fans because the weather was so bad. And it's believed to be the smallest crowd ever for a spring training game there. They left in 1987. They went across the state to Port Charlotte, or Point St. Lucie. And it was the first time, really, since 1925 that we didn't have the New York media here. So we didn't quite the buzz that we had there for such a long time. Cal Ripken and the Orioles came in and shared the facility with the Cardinals for a couple years in the mid-90s. I was the PR director of the Orioles back then. So I had we loved being here. And Sue and I put our girls in school here for a few years and when they were in elementary school, and it was a great experience for us. And then the Cardinals left in 1997 when the Rays came, and that was a 60-year association between St. Pete and the Cardinals. Stan Musial played 19 of those seasons. Great player. He played seven different St. Pete mayors saw him play here. That's how long he was playing here. He played more games, hit more home runs than anybody. When they left, it was, you know, it was bittersweet. We were getting our team, but we were also losing. I talked to so many people that were here for a lot of those years, and it was tough. It was very tough. Vince Domoli, who owned the Rays, decided that the Major League Club would train here. And we were the first team since World War II to actually train in our home. And that happened for 10 years until the Rays left after the 2000. An eight season. I really just tried to write about how, without overstating it, as I said, how influential baseball was in so many stages of the city's development. So it's a history book, it's a baseball book, but I also think that there's some lessons there that how the city was shaped by what went on in that ballpark over there. I mean, I listed 60, I think it must be 60 different things, 60 different events that took place in that ballpark. It was such a point of pride for the city. So many things took place there. And it was clearly a really an important part of the city. So, you know, I hopefully am educating new people that have moved into the community, as we know that there's quite a lot of that going on, that may not even know baseball was even played here since it's been 2008, since it happened. And I'm hopefully for people like some of y'all here, maybe trigger some memories that you might have of that ballpark. You know, it was built, the one that's standing now, Al Lang Stadium, was built in 1977, and while it doesn't have baseball and it makes me sad, I am still happy that it has a function. It's still a part of our community. I do think when you look back at all the many events that were held at those three ballparks, and such a great source of pride. One thing I do want to say, now, spring training baseball actually started here in 1914, but it wasn't over here. It was over near a field at Coffee Pot Bayou, and Branch Rickey brought the St. Louis Browns here. Al Lang got them here. They were here for a year. They left over some economic squabbles, and then the Phillies came in for 4 years, 1915 through 18, and played at the same place. But by 1919, that ballpark was no more. They knocked it down, and part of the reason was the old fire hazard thing. But by 1919, we didn't even have a ballpark. So I kind of like, look, I think the city sort of recognizes 1914 as the beginning of spring training, but we did go 3 years without it until we picked it up again in 1922, and we went, you know, until 2008. So anyway, that's my spiel. The book is sold at pretty much any local bookstore, or you can go online, Arcadia Publishing, or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can get it online. And I just want to thank everybody for your attention and for being here. I need to point out one more thing. I saw another baseball wife walk in. So that's Sue Topkin, who is married to Mark. They covered the Rays every step of the way. So Sue's another one that is a special person. I was talking about baseball wives. So anyway. If anybody has any questions, if not, if you'd like to purchase a book, I'm happy to sign it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but was there also a Negro League park on South Side?
Yeah, you know, I couldn't find a whole lot about that. I think where they played their games, or a lot of the games that I saw some... actually, right here in the museum, I was able to find some, what do they call, like posters and stuff. They played at Campbell Park. And the interesting, and I think that's where they played most of their games.
I actually played there in 71 with Pope Senior High School. That's where it was before they created the new park. And it was all wood, like you said.
Yeah.
Like the old thing. Worried about when it burned down.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's funny. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I forgot to mention the fact that when they were building Al Lang Stadium in, there was 1 year, 1976, where they were building right on the site. So they played, the spring training games were actually played that year. The Cardinals and Mets games were played at Campbell Park. But there was a work stoppage that year, so they didn't have that many games to play. There were only like maybe 10 games played there because of the work stoppage. But you're right, yeah. You want to go with me to city, my next trip over to City Hall? Yeah, I'm all about that. I totally agree with you. There needs to be something. I mean, like I said, but the other thing about what made me interested in getting with the city, and I visited with one of the city council members, and I brought this idea to him, and it didn't really go very far, but I thought it might at that time, because there were statues being built to celebrate our history then. Elder Jordan statue in South St. Pete, the statue at the police station for the 12 police officers, obviously the Tony Janus statue. So I thought, this would fall right in line with that, but I just couldn't get any interest. So I'm not gonna give up. I got an editorial coming in the Times when spring training starts. It's gonna pop them a little bit. Keep poking the bear, maybe we can get something done. But to me, it's not even worth. We shouldn't even be thinking about it. It should already be there. You know, there should be something there. And I went up and looked. I did a little bit of homework. I went up to Orlando, and I wanted to see. My youngest daughter lives up there, and she and I and my grandson, we went over to where the ballpark there was, blank of Tinker Field. And it's not there anymore, but they built a really cool plaza. And it's not an expensive thing, and it's probably the size of this. It would take you 45 minutes to walk around it. There's so much good information about it, not just baseball that went on there. And then I helped Clearwater, the city of Clearwater, with some of their projects, and I helped them with doing something very similar at Jack Russell Stadium. They have like a monument park up there, and it's really cool. It's worth going by and looking at it and seeing all of the great players that played there. So I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, something I think really needs to be done. I just have to find the right vein over there. Thank you.
Rick Vaughn speaking last week. Happy hour with a historian at the St. Petersburg Museum of History. 100 years of baseball on St. Petersburg's waterfront, how the game helped shape a city. My Rick Vaughn is available wherever books are sold.